Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Tuesday, April the 16th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on in our program, we'll be bringing you a regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the announcement by the State of Israel that it has killed a Hezbollah commander in neighboring Lebanon. Fighting has also continued in Gaza between the resistance forces and the Israeli defense units. The Iranian missile attacks on the State of Israel are still being assessed internationally. In the United States, there have been demonstrations which block bridges in solidarity with Palestine all across the country. Zimbabwe has now introduced a new currency for that southern African state. And the humanitarian crisis in the Republic of Sudan is worsening after more than a year of a civil war between two factions within the military. In the second hour, we pay tribute to African-American poet, novelist, playwright, composer, and public intellectual Langston Hughes. This is an address that was delivered during February of 1967 at the University of California at Los Angeles. Finally, we provide more analysis on the situation in West Asia. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude in the East African state of Tanzania with the music of Remy Ongala. Let's listen in.
Somos y consoma. kusoma ye Nyamani nende wapi Sijui nifanye nini Sauti ya mnyonge Sauti ya masikitiko Sauti ya mnyonge Kijijini nimefika nikaambiwa mimi ni mwizi Kendera kala mahindi naambiwa ni mimi Kurua kala miongo naambiwa ni mimi Jenani kaibiwa naambiwa ni mimi jamani Sijue niishi wapi Mimi mkulima Mia mtoto yatima Nyumba nalijenga ya makuti Nalalia ngozi na mbuzi Chini kuna virongoto Pia kuna kunguni Jamani sina umeme Naishi kwa kibatali Sina chandarua Niende wapi Jamani niende wapi Sikupendelea nizaliwe kilema Sikutaka nizaliwe kipofu Nikiomba msininibe Nikipita msinicheke Sauti ya mnyonge Sauti ya machozi Mama yeyeyeye Mama minalia we Mama uko wapi Mama nateseka Meri uko wapi Salamu zao Tukuyu Wanyaju sauti Madaraka uko wapi Salamu zao Mwazao Wasukuma wote Rukia uko wapi Salamu zao Morogoro Wa maringo wote Gala uko wapi Salamu zao Fugu Mama yeyeyeye Mama minali yawe Mama yoyoyoyo Mama nateseka wanani Muziki kuna mwenyewe Muziki ni mwito Muziki ni fundisho Muziki mambolezo kilio Usinione nikimba Ukadhani ninayo furaha Kumbe ninayo huzuni moyoni Muziki asili yake wapi Muziki ni wanani Muziki hakuna mwenyewe Muziki ni mwito Muziki ni fundisho Muziki mambolezo kilio Usinione nikimba Ukadhani ninayo furaha Kumbe ninayo huzuni moyoni Muziki alivyo na nguvu ni mwenguni kote Hata makanisani wanaimba kwaya kwa kuomba Mola Kwa kuomba Mungu Hata kukiwa sherehe za serikali Mbele ya mwenyekiti kuhutubia Ni muziki unaanza kuwakusanya watu Kumbuka Paulo na Sila waliimba gerezani Mungu amewasikia Kumbuka Musa aliimba muziki aina yake kuwakomboa wana Israeli walioutumwani katika nchi ya Misri Ukiwa na sherehe utaimba nyimbo za furaha Ukiwa na tabu utaimba nyimbo za masikitiko Ni muziki pekee ulio na nguvu Itawakusanya wabaya na wazuri Siku ya mwisho Mungu akitoa hukumu Hata kukiwa sherehe za serikali Mbele ya mwenyekiti kuhutubia Ni muziki unaanza kuwakusanya watu Muziki sio uhuni Ama muziki ni uhuni kwa nini unanunua kaseti Ama muziki ni uhuni kwa nini unaomba nyimbo redioni Ama muziki ni uhuni kwa nini unanunua rekodi Ama muziki ni uhuni kwa nini unacheza muziki we Kumbuka siku ya mwisho ikifika utakuwa mulio moja wa parapanda itawakusanya wateule wote walioteuliwa katika pembeni za dunia siku ya mwisho Mungu akitoa hukumu Ukifa leo utapelekwa kaburini na nyimbo za maombolezo Hata kwa Mungu malaika wanaimba Muziki asili yake wapi Muziki ni wanani Muziki hakuna mwenyewe Muziki ni mwito Muziki ni fundisho Muziki mambolezo kilio Usinione nikimba Ukadhani ninayo furaha Kumbe ninayo huzuni moyoni Yeah. makilizi na mwenyewe kifo takusubiri kwa hapo kifo nyambie tukutane wapi hata hospitalini takwenda mwenyewe kwa miguu sitakulaumu tena kifo we nimeacha msimamo nyuma yangu kifo 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 hakina huruma Picha wapi, kipo gani kuwa unorekana kipo gani kuwa tajiri sana kipo tungi kuparushwa kusuri tuishi milele kipo, kipo, kipo akina huruma kipo, kipo, kipo ajue uzuri wako kipo ajue umarufu wako Kipo ajue uko nani, kipo ajani ubondia wako, kipo ajani wewe ni nani, mbele ya kipo wa utambi, kipo, kipo, kipo ni kiboko yao.
Mama,
pea kina dada kina baba heshima sisi wote tumetoka matumboni mwao wape heshima kubwa kote ulimwenguni baba o
Nyumbani, 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 nyumbani,
hata kukiwa kubaya au kuzuri. Nyumbani kwako ni nyumbani, kwa baba yako ni kwako. Mama ni mama, baba hana mfano. Mama kifa kuna mwingine atakupenda kama yeye. Narudi nyumbani yo. Nilipoamua nirudi nyumbani, narudi Songea ho. Nakwenda kulima mahindi, narudi Mlale. Nakwenda kula likolo la nyungu, narudi na nyimbo, narudi Matimila he. Narudi Songea ho. Nakwenda kula likolo la nyungu, wamboni wote muyimuke mwavaloko bagu. Narudi nyumbani ye. Maisha na salama siyo mchezo. Narudi kijijini kutekeleza amri ya nguvu kazi. Ae, narudi majimaji. Oo, narudi Songea ho.
Special worldwide radio broadcast for this Tuesday, April the 16th, 2024. We are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit, That was music from East Africa, from the United Republic of Tanzania. Classic Pan-African music from Remy Ongala. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire report. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. According to an article published in Al Mahadeen, the escalating confrontations in the West Bank are intricately linked to the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the axis of resistance, support for Palestine, and Iran's retaliatory operation, True Promise. In recent months, the West Bank has witnessed a disturbing trend, a surge in attacks by settlers targeting Palestinian individuals and villages. While this pattern of aggression is not novel within the context of Israel's policy of ethnic cleansing, its intensified manifestation, often concealed under the pretext of incidents such as the disappearance of a settler near Ramallah, underscores the volatile attempt of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Amidst this backdrop, the launch of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood emerges as a watershed moment that reaffirms the cause of Palestine as a central Arab and Islamic one, especially amid the existing critical junction on the global scale. Though carried out by the Al-Qassam Brigades, this operation is like a sprout from the deep roots of the ongoing battle for Palestine's freedom, led by what has become known as the Axis of Resistance. Spanning from the Mashriq to the Maghreb, Orient or to the Occident, across the breadth of the Arab and Islamic worlds, the events unfolding in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and throughout occupied Palestine have ignited a widespread response. These developments have set off a chain reaction, leading to escalations not only within the West Bank, but also beyond, fueled by Israel's campaign between wars. This campaign precipitated Iran's remarkable retaliation following an Israeli assault on its consulate in Damascus. Understanding these unfolding events requires contextualizing them within the broader geopolitical landscape, where regional power dynamics intersect with longstanding conflicts and resistance movements. Since October 7th, the Israeli government has made public the displacement of over 250,000 Israeli settlers from their settlements. These settlements, largely constructed on land ethnically cleansed of the indigenous Palestinian and Arab communities, have become targets of Renaissance operations and resistance operations spanning both northern and southern regions of occupied Palestine. In the south, particularly in the Gaza envelope, where Palestinians besieged in the Gaza Strip once resided, a comprehensive evacuation has taken place after the Palestinian resistance breached the Israeli separation walls and entered the settlements before showering its vicinity with missiles that have even reached Tel Aviv on a multiple scale. And you can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. Yesterday in the United States, there were direct actions in solidarity with the people of Gaza and Palestine. In San Francisco, there was a demonstration which was part of the coordinated day of direct action in cities throughout the world demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. Pro-Palestinian activists closed the San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge yesterday, with the overhead imagery showing in this article over the Pan-African Newswire, the whole span congested in one way while lanes in the other were vacant. The demonstration is part of a coordinated day of direct action in cities throughout the world demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. The Ministry of Health in Gaza reported today that the number of Palestinians killed in Gaza due to the Israeli genocide since October 7th has risen to 33,797 and those injured to 76,465. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. The successful adoption of Zimbabwe's new currency, Zimbabwe's gold, the ZIG, is hinged on the positive coverage given by media practitioners. That's according to Information, Publicity, and Broadcasting Services Minister Dr. Jenfan Muswiri. He said this to the Zimbabwe Herald, and this is in an article written by Conrad Mutesa, addressing members of the media attending a two-day workshop on HIV/AIDS in Chinhoy, organized by the National AIDS Council. Dr. Muswari challenged journalists to be ethical and tell the country's story in a positive way. Mr. Mushera added that while the media continue to play a critical role in disseminating information to curb pandemics like HIV, COVID-19, and cholera, some alarmists in the fraternity have been on a drive to discredit the newly introduced currency. Let's all support the Zimbabwe gold, the ZIG. That's our currency, and the country comes first. It is good to discuss, to explore, and to seek clarity, because it's all constitutional in terms of freedom of expression, but the panic and the alarm around doom and catastrophe should not be part of journalism. And finally, world donors have pledged more than $2.1 billion in humanitarian aid for the Republic of Sudan after a year-long war that has pushed its population to the brink of famine. That's according to French President Emmanuel Macron. He said this yesterday. Macron spoke at the end of an international conference in Paris aimed at drumming up support for Sudan's 51 million people. The aid will go to food, water, medicines, and other urgent needs, he said, without providing a specific timeline. Top diplomatic envoys, UN officials, and aid agencies urged Sudan's warring parties to stop attacks on civilians and allow access for humanitarian aid, and call for immediate international mediation efforts towards peace. Members of Sudan's civil society took part in the Paris meeting, but neither the Sudanese army nor its rival parliamentary paramilitary were represented. Today, from this mobilization, all of our presence, it sends a clear message we are sending to the belligerents. We are making a solemn appeal out of respect for international humanitarian rights and for the protection of the civil population, the French president said. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we would like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's program, the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Tuesday, April the 16th, 2024, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Come back.
Detroit's own Motown sound from the Monitors, track entitled Bring Back the Love from 1968. And this is the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast, April the 16th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And right now we want to move into a rare archival audio file of a lecture delivered by the legendary Langston Hughes. And this lecture was delivered on February 16th of 1967. Let's listen to this historic address.
The program tonight will actually be in two parts. After we hear from Mr. Hughes, Mr. Lewis Lomax is going to make a special presentation. We hope you will stay for the occasion. 34 years ago, in 1933, I sat in an auditorium of the St. Joseph, Missouri Junior College, and I heard Langston Hughes, only slightly younger than he is now, read his poetry and talk about his travels. He discussed the Nazis as a pointed reminder of our own brand of dehumanization here in the land of the free, in the home of the brave. Coming from a smaller town in Missouri than Mr. Hughes Joplin, I really didn't understand what the shouting was all about. Today, 34 years later, the message is coming through. Langston Hughes has remained an eloquent spokesman for those who have not been given a proper opportunity to share in America's promises. I would submit that there is a glory in Mr. Hughes' long tenure as a spokesman for our Negro fellow Americans, a glory that transcends his 65 years of good health, attributable in no small part to the fact that he was wise enough to choose relatives, particularly an uncle who at 89 is still a vigorous resident of Los Angeles. But there is a glory in the fact that Langston Hughes has never been one to seek center stage where the harsh spotlight of media, both hot and cold, has enticed a cacophony of new voices. He has not pursued a role of spokesman for the Negro, but rather as an artist who is also a Negro. But his fulfillment of artistic integrity has made him a spokesman, whether he has willed it or not. His main traveled road has been poetry, the poetry of selected poems, the bittersweet poetry of urban life in the best of simple, the basic poetry of jazz music. Langston Hughes knew about soul years before today's hippies picked up the term. He is a working writer. His novel, short stories, autobiography, anthologies, juveniles, plays, histories, translations, and recordings are eloquent evidence. I've always liked this poem. I've been scarred and battered. My hopes the wind done scattered. Snow has frizzed me. Sun has baked me. Looks like between them they done tried to make me stop laughing, stop loving, stop living. But I don't care. I'm still here. And to our good fortune, so is Langston Hughes. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Hughes.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for your very kind welcome back to this campus. I have been here before and have read my poems here before, but it's been some years ago, and I hope that everybody who was here then has now graduated, and because really you're going to hear most of the same poems all over again, except that I don't believe when I was here last time I read this one called Motto. I play it cool and dig all jive. That's the reason I stay alive. My motto, as I live and learn, is dig and be dug in return. Well, I read you that poem because although it was written in the bebop era, about 15 or more years ago, it is seemingly on the way to becoming one of my most popular poems among the retarded readers. It is a poem that's being used increasingly in big city schools and in anthologies. And another poem of mine, which was written a long time ago, really, when I lived in San Francisco, and at one time had the title San Francisco, but I later made it a little broader in terminology and call it City Now, is also finding its way into a great many anthologies for youngsters who never learned to read very well. And it goes like this. In the morning, the city spreads its wings, making a song in stone that sings. In the evening, the city goes to bed, hanging lights about its head. Well, if that poem increasingly is used in anthologies, I think I can make my living off of it for a year or two, because each one pays a nice little fee, you see, and they write me a nice little note and say it's just ideally suited for children who, who are a little over age and can't quite read well. So you can see from those two examples that my poetry on the whole is very simple, because most of my poems are equally simple, really. And I am delighted that we have among the younger Negro poets a number of poets who write very avant-garde, very complicated, and poets whom I myself, try as I do, cannot quite understand. And I asked one of them the other day why they put, one word way over on this side and then two words here, another word way on that side of the page, and then jump down about six pages and put another one with some dots. And I didn't get a very adequate explanation, except that it was a way of keeping the reader's eye moving about the page. Well, I must say that some of those of our younger poets, however, are very talented indeed, and I hope that you will watch out particularly for a young man named David Henderson, who is in some of the avant-garde anthologies, and a young lady named Alice Walker, who's a sharecropper's daughter from Georgia by way of Spelman College, and now has a fellowship to McDowell Colony, where she's working on a novel. 21 years old, a very talented girl, both in prose and poetry. So I just throw out those two names for you in case they haven't reached the coast yet. And then, of course, somewhat older, but young too, and very talented, is a name that I'm sure you've heard out here, Leroy Jones. I hope you know Leroy's poetry, because Leroy is a very talented young man, inclined, to work on the shock side. And I'm sure he couldn't be published in Bruin, because I understand Bruin was recently suppressed for using a few mild bad words. However, he's a very talented young man. His plays particularly are brilliant, and they're about to release Dutchman in the movies. And as an older writer and an older poet and a more conservative one, at least as far as verbiage goes, words go, I'm glad that we have in the Negro race poets like Leroy, because there are a lot of poets like Leroy in the white race, including Allen Ginsberg, whom I just read today was censored out somewhere, some college where he was supposed to speak tonight. I don't know if you've had Leroy here. If you haven't, try and bring him and see what happens, What I was about to say, however, is that I'm glad that we in the Negro race have young people who are doing everything that everybody else does. I think we as American Negroes should do everything everybody else does, and usually when we do something, we often do it better, Or we do it even more far out. So We have some avant-garde poets right now who are more avant-garde than the avant. My own poems, I've been writing poetry since I was, since I was about 14 years old. And I think I'll just start at the beginning and give you a little resume of how and why I began to write. I consider myself very American because I was born in the very middle of our country. I was born in Missouri, which is only a few miles from the dead center of America, because there's a geographical marker in the state of Kansas that marks the heart of the continental United States. And I grew up in Kansas, the very center of the country, until I was about 13 years old. I was born in Joplin, Missouri, but I was not intended to be born there. I belonged to a family that was always moving, and we moved about 10 days before I was born, so I was really born in the wrong place. I was supposed to have been born in Guthrie, Oklahoma. At any rate, I have lived all across America. We moved a very great deal, and before I could remember anything at all, we had moved to Buffalo, New York. Don't remember Buffalo. Then we moved to a place called Concordia, Kansas. Then we moved to Lawrence, Kansas, and I more or less grew up in Lawrence, where the University of Kansas is, so I'm sort of used to academic surroundings. When I was 13, as I started to tell you, we moved to a town called Lincoln, Illinois. It was at Lincoln that something happened that changed the whole course of my life, because I had never dreamed of being a writer or an artist of any sort, but what happened in Lincoln changed all that, and the way it happened was that I entered school late. We moved in October. The eighth grade class that I was going into had decided, they learned the high school class had graduation officers, so they wanted to have them, and they decided to hold an election. And the day I went into this class, they were talking about the qualifications for class officers. And the teacher was telling the class that a president should know how to run a meeting, and the secretary at least should know how to write, and so on. And when she got on to the very last office, the bottom of the blackboard, that was the office of class poet. And she said, and a poet must have rhythm. Poems must have rhythm. She stressed that word two or three times. Well, on the way home from school that day, because the election was to be the next day, the one other colored pupil in the class, a girl, said to me, "Oh, we don't have to worry about that old class election," she said. "They never elect Negroes to anything in these schools here anyway." And it turned out she was just about right. She'd been in the class for the whole eighth grades and had never had a class office of any kind, because Lincoln at that time was a kind of small American town where if you were colored, on the way home from school you couldn't get a hot dog anywhere downtown. If you went into the drugstore, you could buy everything in the drugstore except an ice cream soda and sit down and drink it. Consider the soda fountain. If you went to the movies, they had one row, a half a row, really, on the left, reserved for Negroes. I don't know why they always put us on the left, but they did. And if that one row were, that half a row were filled, you see, we couldn't go to the movies that night. So that was the kind of town Lincoln, Illinois was at that time, named after the great emancipator. Well, when I went back to school the next day, we started out the day by having the class election. And sure enough, all of the officers were elected down to the last office on the board, and the colored girl was not nominated or elected to anything, not even nominated. But when they got down to this bottom office, which was poet, class poet, there weren't any nominations at all. The kids looked around each other, and they didn't see anybody that even looked like what they thought a poet ought to look like, I guess. And there were no nominations. So finally the teacher said, "Well, you have to nominate somebody. Don't you want a class poet?" And they said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, make a nomination. You have to nominate somebody." So a little white boy got up at that point and looked around at me and called out my name, and the whole class said, "I," unanimously, "that's the way I became a poet." Unanimous acclamation in the eighth grade. Well, I didn't want to be cross-put either. I was very puzzled as to why they took me out. But that night, thinking about it and remembering that the teacher is just rhythm, and remembering that all my life I had heard that most American white people think that all Negroes have a sense of rhythm, I said, well, that must be why they picked me out, you see. And I'm glad they did, because I wrote the class poem. It turned out to be 16 verses long. I had all winter to write it, and they had eight teachers, and of course, this was the eighth grade, so a verse for each grade, a verse for each teacher. When I read it at graduation, the teachers, the parents, students, everybody applauded very loudly. First applause I'd ever had in my life, and I was so pleased by all of that applause that ever since then, I've just kept on writing and reading poetry. So that's the way I started out. That's really the truth. The next year in high school, and by the way, we had moved again. We moved to Cleveland, Ohio. And one of my classmates is here tonight from Central High in Cleveland. Well, that was a very famous high school at that time. It was, for one thing, the high school where several of the Rockefellers had graduated, you know? And we had a very good high school magazine. I looked at the magazine. First two or three issues, didn't see a single Negro student writing for this magazine. Well, I, as I've said, feel that Negroes should do everything anybody else does. And so I thought, if there's no colored pupils trying to get into this magazine, I'll try. So I began to send little poems to the magazine. And every month, they came right straight back to my homeroom. I don't think, in fact, I'm sure it wasn't prejudice. They just weren't good. However, after several months of trying, finally one of my little poems was published. From that time on, I sent poems, stories, articles to the magazine, and my first publication was right in school, in my high school publication. I'm going to read you one of the earliest of my poems to be published. It appeared in the Belfry Owl at Central High in Cleveland, and in these two poems I'm going to read you now, you can see the poetic influences on my work. You can see here the influence of Paul Lawrence Dunbar, our very fine Negro poet of more than a half century ago. He died about the time I was born, in the early 1900s. And in the second poem, you can see the influence of a very fine living American poet, perhaps the dean of our American poets now, Carl Sandburg. Because when I tried to write seriously, I tried to write on the one hand like Dunbar, in a kind of singing, lyrical, dialect verse, and on the other hand, in free verse like Sandburg, who was just coming to fame at that time, and who was also being censored. It's very interesting how censorship works. I remember an editorial in the Kansas City Star, I believe it was, denouncing Carl Sandburg because he wrote in free verse. And it was something immoral, presumably, about poetry that didn't rhyme at that time. Well, of course, he's one of our highly esteemed poets, the most highly esteemed, I guess, since the death of Robert Frost, and he's still living. This is a little poem in the style of Paul Lawrence Dunbar called Dressed Up. I had my clothes clean, just like new. I put them on, but it still feels blue. I bought a new hat, sure is fine, but I wish I had back that old gal of mine. I got new shoes. They don't hurt my feet, but I ain't got nobody for to call me sweet. Pretty sad, wasn't it? That was one of the earliest of my, I guess you might say, my love poems. Well, this one was written, the next one, when I was a junior in high school. And it's really about a girl whose name was not Sue. The poem is called When Sue Wears Red, about a girl who came from New Orleans into our class in my junior year, and who, when she walked down the hall in her red dress, looked particularly beautiful to me, so I wrote this poem trying to describe her. I wasn't aware at that time of one of the things that I did in this poem. I was aware that I was trying to write free verse on rhyme poetry, but quite unconsciously, I have a little refrain that suggests the Negro spirituals. And later on, I quite consciously begin to try to create poetry in the style of our folk songs, our spirituals, and our blues, and our work songs. This is the way the poem goes. When Susanna Jones wears red, her face is like an ancient cameo turned brown by the ages. Come with a blast of trumpets, Jesus. When Susanna Jones wears red, a queen from some time dead Egyptian night walks once again. Blow trumpets, Jesus. And the beauty of Susanna Jones in red burns in my heart, a love fire, sharp like pain. Sweet silver trumpets, Jesus. That's the way I felt every time I saw that girl in the hall. But she didn't marry me, she married a football player. And the last time I was back home in Cleveland, I asked about her, and I was told that although she no longer lives there, many friends hear from her and have news of her, I was told that she'd been married 3 times since then. Well, anyway, these poems of mine will indicate to you how I began to write poetry, and the last one will indicate to you that many of my poems, like When Sue Wears Red, are about actual people I've known or places I've been or are inspired certainly by situations in which I've been involved, as are many of my racial poems that I'll read you a few of a bit later. Well, no sooner had I gotten out of high school than I went to live in Mexico with my father. My father and mother were divorced when I was quite small, and he sent for me to come to Mexico, promising to send me to college. I stayed a year in Mexico, and I wrote 2 or 3 very short poems about Mexico, but the most famous of my poems, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, was written on a train going to Mexico. We were crossing the Mississippi River just outside of St. Louis, and I looked out the window of this train, and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river had meant to the Negro people in the past. I remembered my grandmother had told me that in slavery time, to be sold down the river was just about the worst thing that could happen to a slave, sold into the rice swamps of Louisiana, the heat of the Delta. And then I'd read, of course, about Abraham Lincoln going down the Mississippi River and how Lincoln had seen slavery at its worst when he was a young man, seen the slave markets in New Orleans. And, of course, we know that many years later, Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. So all of this came to my mind, and I took out an envelope, my father's letter, really, out of my pocket, and on the back of his envelope, I wrote this poem. Well, now, most of my poems are written that way. They're what you might call spontaneous or improvisational poems, I guess. I'm not the kind of poet who studies and ponders and works in strict forms, and I'm not against writing in the sonnet form or the rondo or whatever forms you may be able to master. It just hasn't happened to be my way of writing. This is a free verse poem, again, as you will notice. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. Well, when I got to Mexico City, my father had planned out my whole life for me. He didn't know me very well, and I didn't know him very well, and we hadn't seen each other for 12 years or more. But he told me that he wanted me to go to Switzerland to college. And I said, well, why Switzerland? He said, because you can learn 3 languages at once. It's a trilingual country. They speak what? Italian, German, and French there. And you can learn mining engineering. There's a lot of money to be made out of mining engineering here in Mexico or South America. So you're going to Switzerland to college. Well, I didn't want to learn three languages at once. I didn't want to learn mining engineering at all. But what I really wanted to do was to see Harlem. I'd never been in New York, never seen Harlem. Well, my father was very anti-Negro, although he was Negro in the in the American sense of the term, you know? And when I use the word Negro, I use it because it's the most common term, but I could say Afro-American, or I could say colored, or I could say, I don't know what else I could say, but anyway, out of deference to those who prefer some other term, forgive me, because I just sort of grew up on the word and I can't get rid of it, and they call me a Negro poet all the time, and my father always referred to American Negroes as being stupid and no good, and he didn't think much of them, and why did they stay in the United States where, with all the color prejudice? Because he had run into some very harsh prejudice in his youth, and one of the things that caused him to leave the United States was that as a young man in Oklahoma, he wanted to be a lawyer. No place where he could study law. He took law by correspondence from a Chicago law school. When he applied to take the examinations for the bar in Oklahoma, they wouldn't even let a Negro take the examinations to be a lawyer. And you know how long it took to open up higher education to Negroes in the state of Oklahoma. And tonight I think we're going to have the honor of honoring a man who broke down the color bar, the first person to break down the color bar in regard to some aspects of higher education in that state. It took about a half a century, you know. Well, at any rate, my father never came back to this country. He practiced law in Mexico City and died there some years ago. I finally was able to persuade him that there was a very good college in New York where you could learn two or three languages if you wanted to and prepare for engineering school called Columbia University. And I didn't tell him I really wanted to see Harlem, you see, at all. If I told him that, he wouldn't have sent me to Columbia. But he did finally pay my tuition to Columbia. First place I went was Harlem, of course. And most of the time I spent down the hill rather than up the hill. So when it came time to graduate, I hadn't passed physics nor chemistry. I'd only passed French and English. I don't mean to graduate, I mean to finish the first year. So I wrote my father and I told him that I decided not to try to be a mining engineer, that I had decided to be a writer. Well, I knew my father didn't think anything at all of writing as a profession, and he had reminded me that Poe Ernst Dunbar drank a great deal and that Poe died in the gutter from liquor and so on, and he had no regard for writing as an art or a profession. But nevertheless, I thought I'd be bold and tell him that I wanted to be a writer, which I did. And I said, but if you don't approve of my plans, you don't need to send me any more money. Well, it soon became evident that he didn't approve because he didn't send me another penny. And I found myself in New York City with $13. So I started out in life with that amount of money, and ever since then I've been making my own way in the world. $7.50 of my $13 went for room rent when I moved off the campus. You know, landlords, regardless of race, take advantage of oppressive situations, and so the Harlem landlords charged higher rents than they did downtown or in neighborhoods where whites could live. Everything was higher in Harlem, and still is. It's very curious to me how, take a box of shoe polish, which will be 12 cents downtown, it's 15 cents in Harlem right now. And if you want to get on the subway and spend 20 cents to go get the polish downtown, you save 3 cents. But why in the world should that be, that we have to pay more in our ghetto areas? I never have understood it and still don't. Well, anyway, I worked at all the kinds of ordinary jobs that at that time a Negro was able to get in New York, a young colored boy or man. I am happy to say that situation has improved greatly, and certainly in New York City, and I think in most of our major cities in the North and West, because you never saw a colored secretary, for example, in an office downtown. Now, all of my publishers and most of the offices where I go have Negro stenographers, receptionists. About three of the bigger New York publishing houses now have colored editors. I mean, real editors who are in charge of... Well, when I say real, they're not just in charge of reading Negro manuscripts. They can turn down a white book if they... if they don't like it. I could only be an elevator boy or porter or shoeshine boy or waiter or something like that when I came along, because I tried the offices. And some of them I was told quite frankly, well, we don't hire Negroes here. Well, of course, nobody dares say that anymore. There are many offices, of course, that perhaps still don't hire Negroes, but they don't tell you it's for that reason. They simply tell you the jobs are filled or something like that. However, at that time, in Harlem itself, the Woolsworth stores had not a single Negro clerk, you know? And one thing we must give Adam Powell credit for is that he was one of the leaders in breaking down discrimination in Harlem, right in Harlem. And I am proud to say that my own first picketing was done right on 125th Street. You couldn't eat in Shrapp's restaurant in Harlem at that time, right in Harlem. It's incredible what nerve the, shall we say, the power structure has. Well, all of that, of course, has completely changed. And speaking of department stores and so on, the Woolworth stores, for example, not only in Harlem now are there many, many Negro clerks in all the shops, the larger ones, but all over, I think all over the North. I know all the Woolworth shops downtown New York, Macy's, the smart shops like Lord & Taylor's, very elegant young colored ladies will ask you what you want in a very elegant voice in Lord & Taylor's, you know? Sometimes so elegant it frightens you, really. So you can't say that there hasn't been some improvements in some aspects of our racial situation in this country. So some of the poems that I wrote at that time about working conditions are no longer really timely or really valid. However, here's a poem that I wrote during the Depression. And since it looks as if we are getting sort of tangled up in relief and welfare and that kind of red tape, again, we are already tangled up in it, to tell the truth. During the Depression times, in some parts of our country, it was very difficult for Negroes to get on what they called WPA, the Works Progress Administration, which was the dole, really, in the giving out of jobs to save you from actually dying. And so I wrote this blues called Out of Work. And the WPA, those of you who are too young to know, it was a kind of government relief agency, really. What's the name of they have for it now? You know, Sergeant Shriver, isn't he? When the guy's connected with him. In any case, this is what this man says. It's a blues, and here you see the definite folk influence on my work now. I walked the streets till the shoes were off my feet. I didn't walk the streets till the shoes were off my feet. Been looking for a job so that I could eat. I couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. Couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. WPA man told me, you got to live here a year and a day. A year and a day, Lord, in this great big lonesome town. A year and a day in this great big lonesome town. I might starve for a year, but that extra day would get me down. Well, my father didn't send me any more money, and I couldn't go to college any longer, and I couldn't find a job that offered very much, and I wasn't making enough in New York to enjoy the cultural opportunities of that, to me, quite wonderful city. It's a city I love very much, but I never made enough to buy a ticket to the Metropolitan Opera from washing dishes, you see. So I decided to get on the boats and see the world. So I went down to South Street and West Street, the waterfront streets, and began to try to find work on the ships. At first, I didn't have any success at all, but I had dreams of where these great big boats went. And so I wrote a number of poems at that time, and this is one of them called Waterfront Streets, which described the way I felt. The spring is not so beautiful there, but dream ships sail away to where the spring is wondrous rare and life is gay. The spring is not so beautiful there, but lads put out to sea who carry beauties in their hearts and dreams like me. Well, one of my dreams has always been to see Africa, the motherland of the black Americans, and I never hoped really to get that far away. But my very first job on a boat going across the ocean turned out to be on a ship going to Africa. And it was the dream trip of my life, really. We went all up and down the West Coast from Senegal all the way down to Portuguese Angola. We went up the Congo River, went up the Niger River, and I had a view of one whole side of Africa. In the days when most of the colonial powers that controlled Africa would not permit American Negroes to visit Africa. You couldn't get a visa even to go over there. Well, I wrote a number of poems about Africa, but I'll read you only one of the oldest ones, written about 35 or more years ago, and one of the shortest ones. It's a poem called My People. And I think perhaps I know it by heart. The night is beautiful, so the faces of my people. The stars are beautiful, so the eyes of my people. Beautiful also is the sun. Beautiful also are the souls of my people. That's the way the African people seem to me, and that's the way my brothers and sisters in America have always seemed to me. I've been very happy in recent years that the Renaissance of Africa has brought a greater realization of the beauties, the physical beauties of the African people to our people here, and that now many of our people are dressing, styling their hair, proud to look like the African people from whom we come. Just the other day I saw Abby Lincoln, who's a stunning woman even in the days of hair straighteners, but I think it's much more stunning now that her hair is Africanesque, you know? Nina Simone, many of our artists are following the African pattern, which I am very, very happy about. Happy that we can be proud of being ourselves. Well, in Africa, I saw aspects of the Negro problem that I didn't realize until then were international. We went into ports where the Africans themselves couldn't go in the downtown restaurants, couldn't stay in the hotels. I even saw churches that were segregated right in Africa. I saw one church with a brass rail. The missionaries ran the church, but the white people sat in front, and the Africans to whom they were bringing Christianity were segregated behind the brass rail. Absolutely incredible, but that it was true. So I began to realize that this color problem was not just a local one. And the words of Dr. Du Bois, you know, in his beautiful book, Dark Water, really began to sink in at that time when Dr. Du Bois wrote about the time I was born that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. And he meant the color line stretching around the world. Well, of course, those words are still very, very true because there's nowhere near a solution to that problem of the color line around the world as yet. And so many of my books, many of my stories, a great many of my poems concern just that very problem. And so I will read you now perhaps a half a dozen of the shorter ones of those poems of mine. One of the problems that is very much in the papers of late has been the problem of the ballot and the voting. And I must say that there are steps toward minor solutions in some areas of the South in that regard, and they're largely due to the militancy and the courage and the determination and the lack of fear of the Negro people, like those of the Mississippi Freedom Party. However, this poem, written some years ago, might still very well be true in regard to many areas of the American South. It's a poem called Ku Klux, and it's about a young man who wanted to vote, and in his own words, he tells what happens to him when he went to try to register and vote. Again, a bit of humor in poetry, not very much, but our American problem has so many aspects of humor that it's hard to keep it out of my poems sometimes. They took me out to some lonesome place. They said, "Do you believe in the great white race?" I said, "Mister, to tell you the truth, I'd believe in anything if you just turned me loose." The white man said, "Boy, can it be you are standing there assassinating me?" They hit me in the head and knocked me down, and then they kicked me on the ground. A Klansman said, "Listen, look me in the face and tell me you believe in the great white race." Well, of course, we fought a major war to defeat the ideas of Aryan supremacy, to defeat Hitlerism. We did defeat Hitler, but we didn't defeat Hitlerism in many areas of our own country. Another of the problems very much in the papers these days, in which I'm sure you who live out here are very aware of, is the problem of, what they call in the papers, police brutality. We've experienced it in New York before the Harlem riots, you know. In fact, the term bebop, I asked one of the bebop musicians one time where they got the word bebop for their music. And he said, "Oh, man, don't you know that's from the cops hitting niggas on the head? And every time they hit us, the crowd says, bop, bop, bebop, mop, mop." Well, the feeling was that they used to whip Negroes' heads so often that a rhythm was developed, you see, in Harlem. But after the riots, strange things happened, you know. You can't tell me that riots don't do some good. Maybe it's a bad way of doing good, but in any case, the police in Harlem got so polite, you know, that when they went to arrest a Negro, they'd almost tip their hats for a while. And then also it developed that there were always biracial teams going around. You didn't see that before. The squad cars, all white, you know, riding down the street. Now, ever since the riots, there's a white and a Negro, usually, you see. And when a difficult arrest has to be made, the white policeman always turns it over politely to the Negroes. So at least you have the honor of being arrested by your own race most of the time in Harlem now, you see. When I lived in Watts, and I lived in Watts once for a summer, when was it, about 1934, I was writing a children's book with Arna Bontemps. And I remember distinctly Watts being a very pleasant place in many ways to live, with lawns and nice little houses and nice people. But there was then, at that time, the problem of the police. And everybody felt the police weren't polite to the citizens of Watts because they didn't live there themselves, you see. Funny thing about police, they almost never live where you do. I don't know why that is. Same thing is true in Harlem, you know. You see, all these police who don't live in Harlem because, you know, they don't. And, of course, you see all these nice shopkeepers who are very nice in the daytime. You never see one of them at night. They don't live in Harlem either. So Harlem is still what you call a ghetto community. And I read in the papers that they call Watts a ghetto community, too. In any case, I was coming home one night late, you know, got off the interurban train that runs out there, and two cops come. I guess they jumped out of squad cars or off of motorcycles or something. And the strange thing about the California police, they have these helmets and things. They look like something out of a German movie, really. they're scary, you know. And I was going home all dressed up because I'd been, I think, to see, I think, Judith Anderson in Medea. A very cultured evening. And here come these cops rushing at me, wanting to know where I had been and where I was going. And I said, well, I'm going home. And where have you been? Well, I've been to see Medea. Well, what's that? You know? Oh, it's a bit disconcerting, you see. So I wrote this poem because I've had other similar experiences, nothing serious, but experiences like that in Cleveland, of being stopped in my own hometown by the police. Or I must say it never happened in New York. Maybe that's why I still like New York. I don't know. But in various cities, I have been stopped walking on the street. Where are you going? They frisk you and pat you down, you see. Anyway, this fellow had a harder time than I did, and this poem is called Who But the Lord. I looked and I saw that man they call the law. He was coming down the street at me. I had visions in my head of being laid out cold and dead, or else murdered by the third degree. I said, Oh Lord, if you can, save me from that man. Don't let him make a pulp out of me. But the Lord, he was not quick. The law raised up his stick and beat the living hell out of me. Now, I do not understand why God don't protect a man from police brutality. Being poor and black, I've no weapon to strike back. So who but the Lord can protect me? But we'll wait and see. Well, now, those are all poems of mine that were written some years ago. This one concerns another of our problems. We've got so many problems. You know, you could write a dozen different kind of poems about a dozen different ones. This one's about housing. It's called A Little Song on Housing. Here I come, been saving all my life to get a nice home for me and my wife. White folks flee as soon as you see my problems in me. Neighborhood's clean, but the house is old. Prices are doubled when I get sold. Still I buy. White folks fly as soon as you spy my wife and I. Next thing you know, our neighbors all colored are. The candy store's turned into a bar. White folks have left the whole neighborhood to my black self. White folks flee. Still, there's me. White folks fly. Here am I. Well, rather hard to get rid of us, but it's not our fault, you know. We didn't ask to come here. We didn't migrate here like practically all of the other Americans of other ethnic stocks. We were brought here, captives in slave chains. I am the American heartbreak, the rock on which freedom stumped its toe, the great mistake that Jamestown made long ago. Well, the mistake was made, and unfortunately, white America has to put up with us, but also, unfortunately, we have to put up with them, so I guess we're in the same boat. There are words like freedom, sweet and wonderful to say. On my heartstrings, freedom sings all day, every day. There are words like liberty that almost make me cry. If you had known what I knew, you would know why. I think the revitalization, or perhaps we should say the vitalization of American students as a whole in the last decade came about largely through the activities of the Negro kids in the Deep South, the young men and women at Greensboro A&T, at Fisk, at Benedict, at Spelman, who started the sit-ins, who went on the Freedom Rides, who brought to the attention of all America the gravity of one of our biggest social problems, who interested thousands of other students on other campuses like Oberlin and like University of California and like Antioch, and who helped to create what has developed into very fine social consciousness on the part of many American students, because 20 years or more ago, American students were in the papers for swallowing goldfish, you know, seeing how many could crowd into a phone booth at once and things like that. And I'm happy to say that the scorn that European students used to feel for our students, that we were infantile, is no longer true, because in Europe now, and I was there not many months ago, you read about student activities here which are meaningful, which have some real social meaning, you know? Well, let's see, I would like to perhaps read you two or three other poems. I started out reading you two poems of mine for children. This is a poem about a child. This is perhaps a poem of mine that's most often used or has been in interracial gatherings and people working for racial betterment as a way, I guess, of stressing one aspect of our problem. The poem is about, as I imagine, a little girl of 7 or 8 years old who, belonging to one of those migratory families, a Negro family always looking for a better place to live or better job opportunities, the child is brought up from the South with her family, and perhaps they go to Oakland or Detroit or Buffalo. And in this northern city, this little colored girl who has grown up accustomed to segregation in the Deep South and uncertainty doesn't quite know when she goes to a carnival whether she can ride on a merry-go-round or not. And she wants to ride. So this is what she says. "Where is the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round, mister? Because I want to ride. Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's the horse for a kid that's black?" One of the aspects, of course, of the one phase of the student movement has been its interest in war, and particularly the current war. This is a poem of mine called "Without Benefit of Declaration." "Listen here, Joe. Don't you know that tomorrow you got to go out yonder where the steel winds blow? Listen here, kid. It's been said tomorrow you'll be dead out there where the rain is lead. Don't ask me why. Just go ahead and die. Hidden from the sky, out yonder you'll lie. A medal to your family in exchange for a guy. Mama, don't cry." Sometimes if there's a question period, I'm glad there isn't one, because poetry is poetry and practicality is practicality. And in question periods, people usually ask very pointed and factual kind of questions. And they will ask you, for example, "What do you think about the Viet Cong, you know?" Well, all I can say about the Viet Cong is that I don't see how anybody in their right minds would want to be captives of the Americans. Because we have been captives for 300 years. And we know what it's like. And they read about us, you see. In papers all over the world, you'd be amazed how almost every day there's a front page picture and on the front of the Paris Press or Le Monde of some Negro being drugged down the street by some white policeman. They love to publish those kind of pictures abroad. I'm sure they publish them in Vietnam. And those Vietnamese see those pictures, well, they don't want any parts of that, I shouldn't think. Police dogs, you know, tearing at little children. fire hoses spraying high school kids way down in Africa last spring. On the very front page, you know, pictures of riots over here. And they never show a picture of a Negro beating a white person, you know. It must happen sometime, I guess, but those pictures just never get into the European press. So the American image is not good in Europe, you see, and I'm sure it's even worse in Asia, and therefore I can't imagine the Viet Cong passively accepting captivity. But anyhow, strange things happen in the world, and my poems about the war haven't yet been translated. Almost all my other poems have been translated even into Vietnamese and Chinese. In concluding, I want to read you, I think, two or three other poems, not quite so serious. Yes, I'd like to read you one more racial poem, really. It's a poem from my most beautiful book. Look at it. Isn't it pretty? Don't say it's the best book, but it's the best looking book. So if you want a nice book to lay on your library table and not, you know, don't have to read it, get this one, and it's called Ask Your Mama. A lot of critics never quite got the point of Ask Your Mama. And all I could tell them to do was, if you don't understand it, ask your mama, you see. But anyhow, it contains a poem, well, it's all one poem, really. It's all written to be read to jazz in several sections, and I have read it to the music of Buddy Collette, for example, and out here, and to, to a number of jazz people, Charlie Mingus in the East, and I will read it to you now from a condensed version of one section of it, because it's... To read you the whole poem, it takes about 15 or 20 minutes. The section I'm going to read from is called Cultural Exchange. And I have just had the honor and the pleasure of being sent on a cultural exchange by the State Department. I was sent to Africa to read my poems to the African people and read them all the way from Dakar to Nigeria to Kenya and Dar es Salaam. Well, Africans have been coming to our country too in increasing numbers, and I think that is one good aspect of something that's happening culturally between our country and our homeland. The Africans, contrary to what some people try to spread, have, as far as I could tell, a very high regard really for the Negro people of this country, the black people of this country. And they particularly welcome teachers over there. I saw quite a number of colored teachers in almost every African country I visited. And they're very proud and very happy to have them. And the teachers seem to like the country and like to and get along well. Ethiopia, for example, there are a number of American technicians and two or three physicians in the Ethiopian capital. And unfortunately, they don't need people without skills. Many of us would love to go to Africa, but unless we are skilled, there's really no way to make a living, and they don't need you. They welcome you if you've got some money or can live, but don't go there without skills. I just simply tell you that if you have technical training, if you want to open a laundromat even there, there are some good, very good laundromats run by American colored people in Nigeria. And things like that are very badly needed. Well, this particular poem, if I can find it, is a poem about what we dream of. It's a condensation from Ask Your Mama. And it should be... should be right along in here somewhere. I am not a poet who ever learns my own poems unless they're very, very short. I don't really like them that well. I know more of Dunbar's poems or other poets than I do of mine. And this would be a rather hard one to learn anyhow. It's a satirical poem, and let's see where it is. Ah, here it is. Yep. Meanwhile, while I have been looking for it, I come across a very, very short one, a new poem of mine, written since my trip to Africa. And one of the things I found over there is that it's absolutely wonderful to be the head of your own government as an African, because 20 years ago, Nigeria and Kenya and all those countries were completely dominated by whites. And now they have their own presidents, their own cabinets, their own customs officials, their own air stewardesses, and in some cases aviators. They're training people to man the planes very rapidly. But underneath it all, when you go to the bank, who do you see in the bank? When you go to get your traveler's checks cashed, who cashes them? When you go to the government buildings, very often the people who are actually in charge of the financial activities are former colonialists. Well, now the explanation is that they have to have these people because they're in a stage of transition. But you look a little further, who's buying the cocoa beans from Ghana? Who's buying the metals from Ethiopia? The whole economic structure of the world right now, I guess perhaps always will be, increasingly so in modern times, is that everybody really is dependent on everybody else economically. America needs magnesium or whatever comes out of the Congo to make atom bombs. Africa needs Frigidaires. They love Frigidaires over there, and they can't get enough of them, but they can't make them. So you see, there has to be this exchange, I suppose, of the economics of modern living. Anyhow, this is a rather satirical little poem, I guess, called Frosting. Freedom is just the frosting on somebody else's cake, and so must be till we learn how to bake. Now, for the poem that I've been trying to read you for the last 10 minutes, this one and one other in closing, this is called Cultural Exchange. In the quarter of the Negroes, where the doors are doors of paper, dust of dingy atoms blows a scratchy sound. Amorphous jack-o'-lanterns caper, but the wind won't wait for midnight for fun to blow doors down. By the river and the railroad, with fluid far off going, boundaries bind unbinding, a whirl of whistles blowing. No trains or steamboats going, yet Leontines unpacking. In the quarter of the Negroes, where the doorknob lets in neater more than German ever bore, her yesterday past grandpa, not of her own doing, in a pot of collard greens is gently stewing. Pushcarts fold and unfold in the supermarket sea. And we better find out, Mama, where is the colored laundry mat since we moved up to Mount Vernon? In the pot behind the paper doors on the old iron stove, what's cooking? What's smelling, Leontine? Leader, lovely leader, and a leaf of collard green. Lovely leader, Leontine. You know, right at Christmas, my next-door neighbors asked me if my blackness would rub off. I said, ask your mama. Dreams and nightmares. Nightmares, dreams. Oh, dreaming that the Negroes of the South have taken over, voted all the Dixiecrats right out of power. Comes the colored hour. Martin Luther King is governor of Georgia. Dr. Rufus Clement, his chief advisor. A. Philip Randolph, the high grand worthy, in white-colored mansions, sitting on their wide verandas. Wealthy Negroes have white servants. White sharecroppers work the black plantations, and colored children have white mammies. Mammy Falbus. Mammy Easton. Mammy Wallace. Dear, dear, darling old white mammies, sometimes even buried with our family. Dear old Mammy Falbus. Culture, they say, is a two-way street. Hand me my mint julep, Mammy. Hurry up. Make haste. And the last poem of mine to be published, which came out in The Nation just last week, I believe, is a new one that I've never read before in public. And so just before I read you the last one that I want to read you, I'll read you this one called Crowns and Garlands. Because, you know, one is always hearing from kindly white friends, look at the progress the Negro has made. And they will point out various areas of progress, which it is true has been made in race relations. And they will always point out, and you have Leontine Price, and you have Ralph Bunche, and Nina Horn, and Sidney Poitier, you know, got an Oscar and so on. Well, we do have, and we're very proud of having them. And this is a poem about them called Crowns and Garlands. Make a garland of Leontines and Ninas and hang it about your neck like a lei. Make a crown of Sammy's, Sidney's, Harry's, plus Cassius Muhammad Ali Clay. Put their laurels on your brow today. Then, before you can walk to the neighborhood corner, watch them droop, wilt, fade away. Though worn in glory on my head, they do not last a day, not one, nor take the place of meat or bread or rent that I must pay. Great names for crowns and garlands, yea. I love Ralph Bunche, but I can't eat him for lunch. Well, kind of cynical little poem, I guess. It's very nice to have wonderful people like some of our very fine artists are. And some of them are very, as you know, socially and racially conscious and do some very wonderful things, each in their way. Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier are unlike many of the older people in the theater of our race, extremely racially conscious, and bring into their monologues oftentimes race consciousness and social significance, you know? And Dick Gregory, of course, you know about. And so we're very proud of all of these people, but nevertheless, the money that they make, the thousands of dollars, and they do make, some of them, an awful lot of money, really, of which I'm very glad. Sometimes I wish I were Sammy Davis myself. The money that they make, some of it is spent as often as they can with the Negro people, but most of it is not, of course, because they don't move in that world where they can spend money for the things they have to have with us and where their managers can, on the whole, be drawn from our race because we don't have people who know all those technicalities of the theater and theatrical law and everything and who get the high fees. And so, all I'm trying to say is that simply in this point, that those of us who are still way down on the bottom and who are still riding for an hour and a half from Watts to a job downtown somewhere, the crowns and garlands, well, they really belong to other individuals. The final poem is called Life is Fine. And as we all know, in spite of all of our problems, as Jerome Cushman told you in the poem that he read, we are still here. And by the way, the gentleman who so kindly gave me such a nice introduction is lately from New Orleans, where the band comes. It's going to play for you on Saturday night, the Preservation Hall Band. And he's a friend of all the members of that band because he was librarian in New Orleans for a number of years. He knows all the musicians. He's a great lover of jazz, as I am. And I think through him I'm going to have the pleasure of meeting some of the members of that band later on tonight. Well, this poem is a poem that might be said to have been derived from jazz because, you know, one of the basics of jazz is that basic beat, which just sort of goes marching on, pounding on, rhythmically dancing on, in spite of everything, in spite of all the hardships and difficulties of life. And many of the great jazz musicians have known prejudice in its worst forms, because many of them are from the Deep South, and they've written, some of them, very effectively about it. Read portions of Louis Armstrong's autobiographies, or read Lady Day, Billie Holiday's book, where she tells about some of her tours in the border states and in the South, and where even to go to the ladies' room, you had to call on the NAACP, and sometimes you couldn't wait that long, you know? So our artists have known what it is to suffer racial opprobrium. In spite of that, they are able to put forth the most joyous music in the world, because jazz is the happiest, the most conducive to dancing, to movement, to laughter, to life, of any music anywhere, and is loved all around the world. And of course it has its sad side through the blues. But under the sadness of the blues, there's always this determination, this marching on, this basic beat that keeps you living. And so this poem, Life is Fine, might be said to have been derived from the blues, really. It's about a young man who thought his girlfriend had put him down. Maybe she had. It's never solved in the poem. And he's thinking about committing suicide. Well, you know, the suicide rate among Negro people is shamefully low. I was talking to a psychiatrist not long ago as to why that was, and she didn't know, this white lady psychiatrist, but she admitted it was true. Also, I read a very interesting piece in the Herald Tribune, I believe, last Sunday, largely about LSD. Perhaps some of you have seen it. And in the course of the piece, it said that LSD doesn't work very well on Negroes because Negroes have a natural cool. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, what an interesting observation. You know, there's a joke, which I expect many of you have heard, about a young colored man who wanted to commit suicide in Atlanta. And he went up on top of this high building and was going to jump down. Of course, those of you who've lived in the South know very well that there's a great taboo on having physical contact with white women in the South. You have, of course, all of us have read about the little 9-year-old boy, I believe he was, in Monroe, North Carolina, who looked askance at a little white girl, his next-door neighbor, they were playing games or something. I believe he kissed her on the cheek and was given a year in reform school. That's the cause of what's his name, being in China now, you know? All that trouble in Monroe really began at that time. And then you know about Emmett Till, 14-year-old Emmett Till, who was thrown in the river with weights on his feet, allegedly for whistling at a white woman. Well, those things are not funny, but this joke is rather amusing about this young Negro who jumped down from this high building in Atlanta, and just as he was about to hit the ground, a white woman came around the corner, so he curved and went right back up. This poem is about a young man who failed, who didn't commit suicide, but not for that reason. This particular poem is called Life is Fine, And following this poem, Louis Lamech is going to introduce the honoree of the evening, so please sit right where you are, and I will go down so I can see the presentation of the award. This young man belonged to a family like mine, I guess, that this poem is about, a family that traveled a great deal, because in the beginning of the poem, you'll notice that streets are mentioned in different cities, and those of you who have lived in Cincinnati will know that Fifth and Mound, for example, is in Cincinnati, and Rampart Street in New Orleans, and so on. So the poem goes like this. Could be Hastings Street or Lenox Avenue. Could be 18th and Vine and still be true. Could be Fifth and Mound. Could be Rampart. When you pawn my watch, you pawn my heart. Could be you love me. Could be that you don't. Might be that you'll come back. Like as not, you won't. Hastings Street is weary, also Lenox Avenue. Any place is dreary without my watch and you. So since you don't love me, it's awful, awful hard. Gypsy done showed me my bad luck card. There ain't no good left in this world for me. Gypsy done told me, unlucky as can be. I don't know what poor weary me can do. Gypsy says, I'd kill myself if I was you. So I went down to the river. I sat down on the bank. I tried to sink but couldn't, so I jumped in and sank. I came up once and hollered. I came up twice and cried. If that water hadn't been so cold, I might have sunk and died. But it was cold in that water. It was cold. The next day I took the elevator, 16 floors above the ground. I thought about my baby, and I thought I would jump down. I stood there and I hollered. I stood there and I cried. If it hadn't been so high up there, you know, I might have jumped and died. But it was high up there. It was high. So, since I'm still here living, I guess I will live on. I could have died for love, but for living I was born. Though you may hear me holler, and you may see me cry, I'll be dog, sweet baby, if you're gonna see me die.
It is with indeed disturbing and mixed emotions that I spent an evening listening to Langston Hughes read, for believe it or not, the first public appearance I ever made in my life. As a little boy, deep in the heart of Georgia, and I rose during Negro History Week to recite The Negro Speaks of Rivers by Langston Hughes. And as one listens to him, one becomes fully aware of what has really happened in American history. For the pathos that is history, the challenge that is the present, they somehow confluence to promise a tomorrow. Indeed, as Langston was reading the poem of the fellow who was on the verge of drowning himself, I thought of But for us then, when I was working for the Hearst Newspaper Syndicate, believe it or not, in Chicago, it was a remarkable moment. A man who happened to be the last person they got out of a burning building in Chicago. The whole place burned down, and he was the last one they got out, and he was obviously high on whatever. And he was stretched out on the grass in the snow, and they shook him, and they said, "Hey, man, wake up." And he woke up, and he said, "Hey, baby, what happened?" They said, "Well, man, the crib's on fire." "Who put it on fire?" He said, "I don't know." They said, "Well, you should know. You're the last one to come home and go to bed." He says, "Well, I still don't know. It was burning when I went to sleep." The humor aside, the Negro looks at America and he can say, "Man, it was burning when I got here." And to the degree that he has been here, he has helped put out the fire. And if the Negro, in the process of becoming a part of America, will maintain his basic, essential self and not sell his soul, then his role, and I think historically this is precisely what it is, his role as part of the spiritual fireman in Western civilization will be fulfilled. We can teach them that man can solve his problems without killing his neighbor. We can teach them that violence is not the answer. We can teach them that he who is right in his cause shall indeed overcome. And there is no greater evidence of the fact that we can indeed teach them than a man who, even then, was a university professor, walked up to the University of Oklahoma and knocked on the door and said, "Pharaoh, let my people go, let me learn." And they said, "No, George Washington McLaurin, you black man, there's no room in the inn." And he looked at them and said, "Well, I'm going to tell it to Earl Warren and a couple of cats in Washington and let you work with that." And he did. And this was 4 years before the Supreme Court decision of 1954. He beat on the door at the University of Oklahoma. The door opened, becoming thus the first real point in historic integration of higher institutions in America. And so tonight, as one who then was a fledgling young reporter who wrote the story, I am deeply honored to present to George Washington McLaurin, for his indomitable courage and fortitude in advancing integrated education, the celebrated case McLaurin versus Oklahoma, 1950, this award from the local Los Angeles, California branch of the Good Samaritan Club for his distinguished service to mankind. How much better a university Oklahoma is that it finally integrated with him. And so for this particular part of the Negro History Week program, I say for the sponsoring groups and committees, thank you and good night.
Welcome back, and that was a historic lecture delivered by Langston Hughes in February of 1967 at the University of California, Los Angeles. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. We're here this Tuesday, April the 16th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment for this program. Motown Sound, once again, from the Marvelettes. Here I Am, Baby. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Tuesday, April 16th. We're going to dive deeply once again into the whole geopolitical situation between Iran and the Israeli state, the struggle going on in Gaza and in contiguous states in West Asia. Let's listen to this report.
For the first time ever, a direct Iranian attack on Israel. A barrage of drones and missiles fired in retaliation for a strike on the Iranian consulate in Syria. Most were shot down, but the world watches with deepening concern. Who'll be saying what to whom to try and bring calm? This is Inside Story.
Hello there, I'm James Bayes. Iran warned it would attack Israel in reprisal for the bombing of its consulate in Syria, and 13 days later it did. A huge wave of weapons launched, most shot down by Israel's air defense systems with limited damage or casualties, we're told. Perhaps, as some analysts have said, it's a kind of high-stakes sparring, with Iran choosing not to unleash much greater firepower it has in its arsenal, a choreographed display to flex Iranian military muscle against its arch enemy, maybe as much for domestic consumption as to send a message to Tel Aviv. However, the diplomatic reverberations are being felt far and wide with fears about what might happen next. So how serious is the risk of wider conflict, and what's being done to prevent that? And is the US President Joe Biden the only person who can now rein in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? We'll be exploring what might happen next with our panel of guests in a few moments. But first, this report from Lina Abu Akleh.
The shockwaves from Iran's attack are reverberating worldwide, with many political leaders alarmed by the barrage of drones and missiles. It's the first time Iranian weapons have directly targeted Israel from Iran. Israel said air defense systems intercepted most of them. Tehran had vowed revenge after Revolutionary Guard commanders were killed in the bombing of the Iranian consulate in Syria 2 weeks ago. The missile barrage increases international worries of sparking a wider regional conflict, but Iranian military leaders sought to draw a line under the latest hostilities.
We see this operation as completed and successful, and there is no intention to continue it, and it's over from our perspective. But if the Zionist regime does anything against us, either inside our soil or anywhere in Syria or other countries, our next operation will be much bigger. If the US gets involved in any action against us, none of its bases will remain safe in the region.
But words from the top in Israel will do little to ease fears of more conflict to come.
This campaign is not over yet. We need to remain prepared and attentive to the IDF's and home front command's instructions and to prepare for any scenario. At the same time, we blocked the first wave of attacks, and we did it with great success.
U.S. President Joe Biden has again vowed to defend Israel, but wants to avoid open conflict with Iran. Since Israel's genocidal war in Gaza began in October, killing and wounding more than 100,000 Palestinians, fears have grown that the violence could explode into a wider war. International diplomats are working frantically to avoid further military action that could have devastating regional and global consequences. Lina Abu Akleh, Al Jazeera, for Inside Story.
Well, we're going to define the significance of this escalation in the Iran-Israel conflict with our panel today. In Tehran, Mohammad Mirandi is a professor at the University of Tehran, and he's advised the Iranian negotiating team at international nuclear talks. In London, Yossi Meckelberg is an associate fellow at the British think tank Chatham House. And in Washington, D.C., Akbar Shahid Ahmed is senior diplomatic correspondent at HuffPost. He's covered U.S. foreign policy since the Obama administration. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us today. Mohammed, let me start with you. We have had literally decades of hostility and proxy attacks between Israel and Iran. But what has changed in recent hours? Would you say that Israel and Iran are now at war?
Well, first of all, the strikes last night against the Israeli regime were very devastating. The Iranians severely damaged two military bases. And the propaganda that we're seeing 24 hours a day, literally now, in the Western media about how little damage was caused is absolute nonsense. The Iranians sent many very cheap drones and old missiles as decoys, maybe a couple of million dollars, and the Israelis spent $1.3 billion to down them. And then the main missiles all got through and struck the military bases. And if the Israelis are so confident about themselves, then I guess today they can take international reporters to see the base, the two bases for themselves. But beyond that, we have to remember that Iran has shown strategic patience for years. And the Israelis carried out assassinations in Iran years past, and sabotage. When that failed, they started to assassinate Iranian officers in Syria who were fighting ISIS and al-Qaeda and their affiliates who were being supported by the Israelis, among others, alongside the Golan Heights. And during the last 6 months, when Iran has been supporting Gaza and the resistance and been opposing the genocide, the Israelis murdered a number of officers of Iran and Syria. And Iran did not retaliate, at least directly, because Iran wanted to keep the focus in the past on the fight against ISIS and al-Qaeda, and now the focus on Gaza, because the Americans and the Israelis and the West want to change the narrative. But since the Israeli regime struck the Iranian embassy and the U.S., Britain, and France and U.N. Security Council refused not only to punish the Israeli regime but to condemn it, Iranians were obviously forced to punish the regime. And this has changed the equation. This is the big change.
Okay, let me bring in Yossi and ask how it's changed the equation. People have talked about this for a long time as a shadow war. Is it now a hot war?
Yeah, it was a direct attack. Let me start what I actually agree with the previous speaker, is that Iran showed strategic patience for many years, and that's, you know, fighting through proxies actually serves the Iranian regime. But it definitely didn't serve it last night. And I don't know where this information about hitting our 90% of the around 350 drones, missiles, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, were intercepted and probably didn't cause much damage. Sadly, it injured badly one young girl. And I think in this sense, the question is what happens next. But it changed the parameters of this conflict from a shadow war for what Israel calls war between wars into a direct one. Now, Iran says on the one hand, this is a closed chapter. We want to move on from there. Israel said it would retaliate. I think in this sense it's better for Israel not to retaliate, because what happened yesterday, after Israel actually experienced months of criticism from its closest allies for the way it conducts the war and the unacceptable way it conducts the war in Gaza, actually Iran and Tehran managed yesterday to unite the United States, some countries in the region, Europe, in defending in Israel. So I'm not so sure in what sense this was a strategic success for Iran. But at the same time, there are pressures within the Israeli government, within the to retaliate. But as it stands, and as you alluded earlier, the cards are with President Biden to ensure that there is no further escalation.
Akbar, how worried are they in D.C.? Because, of course, there's a nuclear dimension to this. Israel doesn't talk about it, but we all know it's a nuclear power. Iran has a nuclear program, and most experts say if they wanted to develop a nuclear device, the breakout time is just a matter of days now.
Absolutely, that's a huge fear. And I think that's an awareness for the Biden administration in particular, which did not pursue, right, the Obama-era nuclear deal that President Donald Trump torpedoed. The Biden administration knows that their choices have brought Iran much closer to nuclear capacity than, you know, ever before. And, you know, Israel right now has a huge incentive to begin a big war. I think for U.S. officials, what they're thinking right now is, how do we get Israel to, as Yossi said, see it as logical and beneficial to not escalate? However, what we know from 6 months of this conflict now in Gaza is that this government in Israel in particular is not being driven so much by necessarily rationality, strategy, achieving its actual war aims. It's being driven really by the political calculations of Prime Minister Netanyahu, and importantly, those around him seeking to succeed him, right? So you showed a clip of Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, very much seen as someone trying to outhawk Netanyahu, right? You've now seen Benny Gantz, the kind of DC preferred alternative to Netanyahu, also come out and say, we want to hit Iran hard. Now, what that means for the U.S. is, even if they're in a scenario where the Biden administration can avoid an Israeli escalation against Iran, I think that they then feel they lose political capital to stop Israel from doing other things they don't want Israel to do. So that means the operation in Rafah, in Gaza, which the U.S. is extremely worried about what that would look like and what that would mean for Palestinians, for international opinion against Israel. That also means Lebanon, right? That's the place where Israel could say, okay, if you're not going to let us hit back at Iran in some huge dramatic way, we have been kind of chomping at the bit to go into Lebanon. And I think there's a real fear among U.S. officials that the leverage to stop either Rafah or Lebanon is now quite low on the U.S. side, especially because President Biden chose in this moment to revert to what's called his bear hug strategy with Israel. So demonstrating overwhelming military, diplomatic, rhetorical support for Israel in a bid to kind of gain American influence. That hasn't worked in Gaza. So I don't know if it'll work for the Americans going forward.
Looking at the scale of the attacks, Mohammed, you are telling us things that are not what we are hearing from the Americans and the Israelis. You say that two bases were hit and severely hit. We've got no pictures of that. We've got no reporters to go to the scene. And yet the narrative that's coming out from the US side, let me quote you, the National Security Council spokesman of the US, Admiral John Kirby, an incredible military achievement by Israel is just an extraordinary example of military superiority. What do you say to that? And, you know, isn't this damaging for Israel's, as for Iran's military reputation in the region and damaging for domestically for Iran?
Are these the same Americans who are saying we have no evidence of genocide in Gaza? Or are these the same Americans who are saying that our intelligence says that there were tunnels under Al-Shifa Hospital? Or that the resistance, they bombed their own hospitals. I think that's the same intelligence agency, so I wouldn't take it too seriously.
Okay, you made some specific claims, which I haven't seen elsewhere before this program.
Yeah.
Certainly the Israelis are saying that a base called Nevatim, which is in the south of Israel, in the desert, that suffered some minor damage. Just to be clear for us, where is the other base
First of all, it's very surprising that in this base in southern Israel, only a small little girl was severely wounded. I wonder what she was doing there. But all you have to do is ask the Israelis to let you see the base and take a comprehensive tour of the base, and I'm sure all is well. But if really indeed the Israeli regime was successful, then why are the Americans so worried about the expansion of the conflict?
Okay, Mohammed, sorry to interrupt, Mohammed, but just to be clear, because you made an allegation about two bases. Can you name the other base for us, please?
Yes, it's an intelligence gathering base, which the Israelis are using against the resistance in the north and in particular in Syria. So I think, you know, this 99% stuff reminds me of the elections of these governments that are controlled by the United States, these presidents, which all get 99% of the vote. The fact is that the Israeli regime last night was humiliated, and the Iranian hit them back. And when your guest goes and says that Arab governments what their position may be, we have to look at what people on the streets are saying, not at what governments are saying. In fact, if the greater the gap between the governments and the people in the region when it comes to Israel, the worse it is for those governments. So when, for example, the Jordanians are seen to be siding with the Israeli regime, that's the Jordanian government. That's not the Jordanian public. Let's separate these two. But again, as I said, if the Iranian offensive capabilities are so weak, then the United States should encourage the Israelis to attack Iran again. But I think the Americans know that if Israel strikes Iran again, the response will become even more harsh this time around.
Benny Gantz, one of the key members of the war cabinet, Yossi, is saying that Israel will extract a price in a time and manner of Israel's choosing. Do you think it plays into this in any way, into the calculations of exactly what scale Israel's response is, the fact that this attack by Iran was very clearly telegraphed in advance? It took place at a time when both Israel and the U.S. were on the highest state of alert, and the fact that there were no deaths.
Well, there was an element of a theater in all of this, where we could watch at home and actually know exactly when the drones and the ballistic missile and the cruise missiles were launched. And what we hear now, that basically there are two Iranian narratives that contradict each other, but one for domestic consumption and one for international and strategic reason. For domestic reason, it's presented as a great success, and there is some story about Israeli bases badly hurt, though you can imagine that satellite imagery by now would have exposed something like this and it'd be revealed in public. So this probably is a kind of a narrative developed domestically in Iran. On the other hand, it was almost obvious that Iran didn't want to hurt Israel too much because they understand the consequences of it, and they didn't want to push either Israel, the United States, the region, into a cascade war. So between the strategic and the need to appease some domestic pressures, there can now some not only paradoxes, but there are tension. And what Benny Gantz, which is one of the more responsible members of this cabinet, says, you know, Israel will choose its time and the manner of retaliation. In other words, Israel doesn't need to retaliate right now, because there was no major danger and major threat or major damage to Israel. Let's remind ourselves, actually, the damage was caused 2 weeks ago, and everyone expected and accepted that Iran, to a certain degree, has the right to respond to that. The question was, is the time, the scope, and the place. And now we know how it happened, then everyone can move on. And again, Iran, in many ways, by fighting through proxies, was better off. And while Israel has been criticized for the last six months and being isolated, right now, Iran actually made Israel standing internationally in a way better stand.
Akbar, we seem to have evidence that the U.S. did get a direct warning, and certainly the Iranian side are saying that they did warn the U.S. The evidence I have, for example, the U.S. President Joe Biden was at his home in Delaware, and then he hurried back to the White House because he knew this was coming. As a diplomatic correspondent for your organization, how much knowledge do you have of what's been going on behind the scenes in recent hours and days?
Yeah, there are two channels between the U.S. and Iran to kind of pass these messages of deconfliction or any other kind of important message they need to pass, right? So one is through the Swiss, who are sort of the guardian of any diplomatic relationship, whether it's a tie between two countries. And then Brett McGurk, who is President Biden's quite controversial Middle East advisor, but very influential. Brett McGurk has been running his own kind of channel in recent months in Oman, an Arab state that does maintain some degree of relations with Iran. So there are these channels, and certainly it's understood in D.C. that Tehran does not want to escalate in some huge way right now, and also perhaps does not have the bandwidth to do so. I mean, given the regional situation where, yes, Arab states are very conscious of their population being protected by Palestinians. They're also very worried about Iran. I mean, that's indisputable. There's a lot there, right? And then there's Iran's own domestic situation coming now almost 2 years after mass protests over the killing of a civilian woman. So there's a lot of reasons why Iran may not want to escalate right now. Washington doesn't want to escalate. But I think the wild card here remains that Israeli cabinet, right? And I think one thing I just want to highlight is that in this moment of bluster, in this moment where we're still talking incredibly, right, after escalations on both sides, the Israeli attack in Damascus, the Iranian attack today from Iranian soil into Israel, we're still talking about further escalations. Okay, now who's going to punch back in a bigger, scarier way? And that's exactly the kind of talk that a lot of U.S. officials don't want to see. And Conversely, at the political level in the U.S., we see President Biden and a lot of lawmakers, especially Republicans, saying the time is right to send $14 billion more weapons to Israel, right? So that's the stalled military package that Biden has wanted since the start of the Gaza war. So while there's a lot of hesitation, there's also a lot of political maneuvering, including in D.C. and in Israel, to escalate further and to arm Israel more, which leads to greater risk.
Mohammed, let me ask you about diplomacy that might be going on behind the scenes. You've heard Brett McGurk maybe talking, Akbar is saying, directly to the Iranians. What's your understanding of any direct contacts? Because, of course, Brett McGurk was part of the Obama administration, as are many of the officials in the Biden administration. Bill Burns, the CIA director, he was involved in nuclear diplomacy. Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, he previously was involved in negotiations with the Iranians. You know all this well, Mohammed, because you were an advisor at one point to the Iran nuclear team. Are there direct talks between the two sides?
No, there are no direct talks between Iran and the United States, and we have indirect communications between the two countries that have been utilized for years now. And of course, the Iranians have sent messages to the United States, and the United States has sent messages to Iran, and the United States knows quite well that escalation is not something that's in the interest of the United States. If the United States were to get involved, these very same missiles and drones that are highly capable will destroy U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf region and then across the region. And those countries that host those bases will be seen as complicit. And that would bring about massive destruction, and it will destroy the global economy because energy prices will go through the roof. So the Americans, they have enough sane people left in Washington, I think, that would understand that they can say the propaganda about how all the drones and missiles were stopped and all that, and how in Gaza Israel is winning and how in Lebanon they're winning and the Americans are winning everywhere, and how Russian drones and missiles are all shot down. They're also being shot down, 99% of them in Ukraine, but the Americans are losing across the board, and the West is on the decline. And so
okay.
Let me
bring in Yossi on this, because it's pretty clear the U.S., I think all of you are saying this, wants to draw a line under this and stop any further escalation, and that seems to be Iran's position too. But Yossi, we've seen President Biden in the last 6 months give unconditional support to Israel to defend itself. We've seen President Biden send a naval armada to the region. We've seen him provide diplomatic cover for Israel at the United Nations. And we've seen him continue, despite all the deaths of civilians, to send weapons to Israel. And yet, whenever Biden has said, show restraint, respect my red lines, Netanyahu does not listen to him. So what sway does Joe Biden have over Israel and the current Israeli government right now?
And I think we need to differentiate between the U.S. Policy when it comes to Gaza, and I think we should have seen a way more proactive President Biden in stopping the war, the ceasefire, humanitarian ceasefire, and allowing more humanitarian aid entering, the release of the hostages, and so on and so forth. There was not enough pressure on Netanyahu. And differentiate from the attack last night, that I think the United States and the other allies were right in stopping these incoming drones and missiles. But when it comes to the United States, it has all the cards when it comes to Israel. If it wants, it can actually put enough pressure on Israel. Again, not necessarily to do exactly what Washington wants, but enough sometimes to save Israel from itself. And the way, and the thing I agree with, I think a lot of what is, I disagree, because actually Iran is supporting all the wrong causes right now in the Middle East and also in Russia in its war with Ukraine. But when it comes to Gaza, Israel is not winning the war in Gaza. It's making only make it worse for the Palestinians and for Israel. And if it's the role of the United States, actually, to help Israel to get beyond the war, to think about the day after in Gaza, and try to build also a new security architecture in the Middle East, which will include peace with the Palestinians, more inclusive, including of Iran, but at the same to look at Iran as not an adventurous force that destabilized the region.
So you say that the U.S. has all the cards, Yossi, and has not been prepared to use them until now. Akbar, we heard Mohammed talk about potential economic meltdown globally if this was to expand into an all-out war between the two countries. Well, just 7 months away, you've got a U.S. presidential election. Do you think President Biden is prepared to use all these cards now?
I think it's indisputable that if a major Middle East conflagration occurs, which would, as Mohammed mentioned, include right Iranian or proxy strikes on U.S. bases, probably in the Persian Gulf, probably shutting down shipping routes and energy exports, that would be a huge blow to American global influence, to President Biden's re-election prospects. I will say the U.S. knows it has the leverage, right? So I think one factor in this conflict that hasn't gotten enough attention is that in a couple of spaces, President Biden has used that leverage. So on October 10th, for instance, we know from the Wall Street Journal that Israel was ready to strike Hezbollah in Lebanon, right? They had made a decision. They wanted to expand the war. President Biden had a 45-minute phone call with Netanyahu and said, this is not happening. What I think is so striking about that is that means Biden and his team have known since October 10th that it will take one phone call to stop Israeli actions, whether it's in Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, where they say they're quite concerned, and also regionally. They haven't made that choice broadly. I think their calculation could shift as we get closer to the election. And I do think zooming out to the broader picture, yes, President Biden is thinking about his re-election in November, but he and his team, this has been one of the handicaps of their Middle East approach, unfortunately, but it remains one of their focuses. They see themselves as these adults in the room, right? Not just dealing with the conflicts of today, but setting the stage for U.S. relevance on the world stage in the future. So they are very much thinking about the Pacific. They're thinking about the war in Ukraine and European security. And from that point of view, they do not want some destabilizing factor, some destabilizing conflict in the Middle East right now that upsets the relationship stability in the Pacific, right, and upsets energy security there. They do not want some kind of shift of Arab states towards Russia, feeling that Russia is more successful in Ukraine. So they're very conscious of those factors as well as they're making their decisions on that.
Okay. Thank you very much to all three of you, our guests today, Mohammed Mirandi, Yossi Mechelberg, and Akbar Shahid Ahmed. As ever, Al Jazeera aims to give you the most comprehensive coverage of what's going on in the region. And you can always find context and analysis on our website, aljazeera.com. Your views are much appreciated too. You can contribute on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. Or find us on X, where we're at AJInsideStory. From all the team here in Doha, please stay safe. I'm James Bayes, and I'll see you back here very soon. Bye-bye for now.
That was a panel discussion on the current military and political situation involving Iran, the Palestinian question, and the issue of Israeli settler colonialism. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for this Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. We're going to close out with the legendary guitarist, jazz guitarist, Grant Green. This is from a 1964 album entitled Idle Moments. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.